art wants to be transformative. I don't think art wants to be pretty pictures on the wall. I don't think art wants to be decorative.
Coming up on In Contrast, Ruth Osecki, Amilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Ruth Osecki is an author of fiction and nonfiction, a filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest. Her novel, A Tale for Time Being, won the LA Times Book Prize and was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. In her most recent work, The Face, A Time Code, Osecki writes about observing a reflection of her face in a mirror for 3 hours and the thoughts that arose during that time. She is currently a professor at Smith College. Ruth Osecki, welcome to In Contrast. I am delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much, Ilan.
I want to start with a reflection, a meditation that you did on your face called A Time Code. And start with the very word time. In what way are our faces, in what way is your face an expression of the passing of time, the passing of your time, and also the passing of my time and society's time?
Mm-hmm. That's a nice question. And I think that question is actually what prompted me to write the essay in the way that I did. The assignment was to write an essay about my face. And we were given a wonderful quote by Borges to kind of play with and to inspire us. And so this idea of the face as being a kind of a map, a cartography, was interesting to me. But of course, because I'd been thinking so much about time, I started to think of it more as a map that emerges through time somehow. And so the way that I then set up the essay was to sit in front of a mirror for 3 hours, which was a painfully long period of time, and to examine my face during that period. And my hope was that somehow through this long examination that I would be able to look at my face and see through the surface layer into something that came before somehow. And in fact, that is what happened. As I was looking at my face, I started to notice a scar that I had gotten in a sledding accident when I was 7 or 8 years old. And looking more deeply, I started to see my mother's face, and then I started to see my father's face. This was, of course, something that I'd been aware of, too, over time. I mean, as we get older, we start to see our parents' faces in our faces, right? Which can be a really frightening thing. So it was interesting to kind of be able to explore that and to really study and get very intimate with my, you know, at that time, 59-year-old face and see what was there just sort of beyond the surfaces. And so I think that the essay sort of organized itself around this time code, and then I was able to sort of spin off and write about other things too, you know, write about the kinds of memories. But what I began to realize was that the face is a map that goes, it's not just my face and my parents' faces. This thing here that is on my head that sort of leads me forward, presumably into the future, if you imagine time as being ahead of you, it actually is this construct that has evolved really over the millennia. It's a very, very old thing that I sit here and peer out of. And we have these tremendously long lineages that we carry around on our faces.
So you see the ancestors and maybe also the successors that are represented in the face, but also the varieties of you before you arrive to the face that I am seeing right
yes,
now.
Yes.
And maybe the possibilities of the face that I'm not seeing, but that will exist in the same place in the future.
Mm-hmm.
A mask as well?
Of course, I think that there's always a mask-like element to the face. To some extent, we construct that.
Do you think that there's a different way in which men look at our face and women look at the women's faces?
I can't imagine that there is not a difference, but I've never actually sat down to compare this experience. We're raised to think of ourselves as bodies and faces, and the surfaces count, they matter, in ways that I think that it must be different for men somehow. And this is something that we're taught to do at a very, very young age, and we do it fairly unconsciously. But that would be interesting, wouldn't it, to actually sit down and think about and compare.
And if I can push you,
yeah.
Do you think that there's a different conception of time in men and in women? If the face could be seen differently, and you're saying that you're beginning to think of this, that it's a good possibility, do you think that there's a different internal clock, not only in individuals, but also in genders? And I might ask you, in cultures, is the ticking of the clock different in the East than in the West in general? In the South and in the North, and I'm here using the cardinal points, but we could be more specific about particular nations.
Mm-hmm. I would hesitate to speak. I'm not a man. I don't know what the male experience of time would be, but I can't imagine that it's not very different. The biological clock for a woman is very different than the biological clock for a man. The way that society treats women as we grow old is very different, very, very different from the way that society treats men as they age. A man's aging face is simply not looked at the same way that a woman's aging face is received. So I can't imagine that there isn't a very, very different internal perception, not just in the face, but in the body, you know, going to the very core of who we are. I can't imagine that it's not very, very different. And I think, too, that in terms of cultural differences, yes, I think there's, once again, a very vast difference in the way we perceive ourselves as time beings, you know, as beings in time. Simply because of the way the culture treats us. I mean, America does not celebrate elders. And so I think that as we get older, and especially I think for women as we get older, we start to wonder, are we irrelevant? We're not being valued for the same kinds of elder wisdom that other cultures might praise. Certainly that's not the case in this country. I think that's very different.
A few minutes ago, you talked about time as being before us or in front of us. Yeah. One notices that when people talk about the future, they use their hand mannerisms, and they point forward. And when we refer to the past, we point backwards. But why?
Isn't that interesting, too? Because that's a custom. That's a map that we use here in the modern so-called West. We point ahead, the future, back is time. That's culturally dependent as well. There's a tribe called the Aymara tribe in Peru, and they perceive time in exactly the opposite way. They see the past as something that is in front of us. And the reason is because our eyes are in the front of our face, right? And when we look forward, we can see the past. The past is knowable. It's something that we can see. Whereas the future is unknowable, right? It's unknown. And so it's behind us where we can't see it. So the placement of the eyes determines, in this case, where the past and where the future is in terms of our temporal topography here. That's fascinating.
It's fascinating. Yeah. How has your conception of time changed over the decades? Do you remember how, as a young girl, you saw time? Mm-hmm. And is it very different than, say, 25 years ago and now? Or might we say that we have a constant way of seeing time and just get ourselves adapted to it? What is your case?
I think that our sense of time changes minute by minute, you know, or moment by moment, because of course, minutes and moments, what are they? I think it's very, very dependent on how old you are and what's happening, whether you're interested or bored, whether it's the end of the semester or the beginning of the semester, you know, it's very relative.
And you think that with age, time, those moments or those minutes slow down, become more elastic? Do you think that time is passing by much faster and that in youth is slower because we don't have the conception of it in the same way?
Yes, and also a moment, you know, a minute when you're young is relatively different than a minute when you're 61, right? I mean, it's just the relationship between 60 seconds and 61 years is different from the relationship between 60 when you're 6 years old. I can speak for myself. As I get older, time seems to go much faster, and I think a lot of people say this, and I certainly remember being young and time just feeling like an eternity and always being very surprised when the summer was over, for example, because summer just seemed like this wonderful stretch of time that was just endless. It would go on and on. Whereas now, you know, I look at the summer and it's pretty much over already.
You are a Zen Buddhist priest. I'd love to hear how you became one, how your life changed as a result, in the role that Zen, which appears in your books in a number of different ways, from the face, time code, to a tale of time being, and elsewhere in the conversations that you've given in the lectures, the role that it plays.
Mm-hmm. I have a fairly long relationship with Zen. You could say it's a relationship that began before I was born. My maternal grandparents were Zen Buddhists. They were Japanese. So the first memory I have was the first time I ever met them, and they'd come to visit us in New Haven, Connecticut, and I was sent to call them for breakfast. They had arrived the night before, I think, and I was sent to call them for breakfast from my parents' room, and I'd never seen them before. I didn't know what grandparents were, really. And my mother sent me in, and I think I was three, and I remember opening the door and walking in and seeing these two strange people sitting on the floor. And they were sitting on the floor cross-legged, and they were doing something, you know, with their eyes closed. And this was very, very bizarre because they were my height. They were the same height that I was at the time. And that seemed very odd to me because, you know, grown-ups didn't sit on the floor, and what were they doing? And then my grandfather opened his eyes, and I remember being just terrified, actually, and running from the room. And then my mother explaining to me that, I can't remember exactly how she said it, but that they were meditating. I think she said they were doing exercises or something. But in a way, I feel a little bit like I was a little duckling that kind of imprinted on this image. Because when I was, I think, 7 or 8, I had a little book about Zen, and I was reading the koans and thinking they were very mysterious and enigmatic and fascinating. And I remember trying to meditate when I was 9 or 10 or 11. And meditation was something that I was drawn to at various times in my life. I think I was initiated into transcendental meditation when I was 14. And so anyway, I had this kind of long flirtation with meditation throughout my life. But then when I was in my, I guess it was in my late 30s, my parents were getting older and they were ill. And it became very clear to me that there was an end in sight. And as in the traditional tales of Buddhism, it's sickness, old age, and death is what wakes you up to the ephemeral nature of life. And that's exactly what happened. And I suddenly realized that time was running out. And that I wanted to somehow learn how to be with this knowledge, this certain knowledge that my parents were going to die and that I would too. And so I started really taking Zen very seriously at that point. I started a serious meditation practice. I started working with a teacher. And really, I think that the Zen practice, starting in about the year 2000, really was what sort of stabilized me through the last years of my parents' lives and enabled me to help take care of them and do all of the things that one needs to do as a daughter at the end of one's parents' life. That was really the start of it. And then, too, the more I did it, the more I realized that it was helping me in every part of my life, including my writing life. And I just then decided that it would be nice to ask for ordination so that I could help pass this on to other people as well.
What is the difference between the way your mind works when you're meditating and the way your mind works when you're writing?
Oh, yeah. Very different. It's very different. There are similarities, I think, but it's very different. The first thing when you sit down to meditate is you actually don't start with the mind. The mind is not really the focus at all of the meditation. The focus of the meditation is the body and the breath. And so those are the first foundations. They're called the foundations of mindfulness. We have this funny conception, right, that our mind is somewhere up in our head behind our faces, right? Mm-hmm. But when you sit down to meditate, of course, you're assuming a posture. And so you're paying attention to your posture and you're paying attention to your breath. In a way, you're allowing your mind, or your mindfulness anyway, to fill your body so that you're aware of where your body is in space. You're aware of all of your five senses. And this is interesting too, because actually in Buddhism, we have 6 senses. We have the 5, you know, eyes, ears, nose, skin, the normal 5 senses. But the mind is also considered a sense. They're actually called sense gates. And so the mind is a sense gate. And through the mind, we perceive thoughts. But the thoughts that we perceive are basically pretty much the same as feeling the sensation of heat, for example, or smelling a flower, or having an itch, right? The thought is just another sensation, passing ephemeral sensation like that. So in any case, when I'm meditating, my mind, my attention, my awareness is really filling my body, and it's not up here somewhere in my head behind my eyes, and I'm not really thinking about anything in particular. And the instruction for Zazen, for Zen meditation, is think, not thinking. How do you think, not thinking? Non-thinking.
What's the difference between the two?
What, think and not think?
Oh, and not thinking.
Yeah. Think, not thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you think, not thinking?
Right.
Non-thinking. So then you can ask what the difference is between not thinking and non-thinking. That's a good thing to meditate on for several decades.
And so when you are writing, you are thinking?
When I'm writing, sometimes I'm thinking. Sometimes I'm listening. Sometimes there's a sense of spaciousness there. And I suppose in this sense, it is not dissimilar to a meditative mind, a mind in meditation. You know, I guess the metaphor that I like to use is the mind as a hand. So when you're meditating, you relax the muscles in the hand and your palm just opens. And so thoughts can come and go with this relaxed palm of the mind. And I think it's true with writing too. Sometimes, certainly when I'm stuck in writing, if I try to grab and tighten around the stuck place and try to figure it out in that kind of way, it's almost like the muscle gets cramped and it gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And so what I try to do then is to relax. I do the opposite. And I use a kind of body meditation to do that. And then the mind relaxes around the problem. And you can call it anything you'd like. You can call it intuition. You can call it the muse. You can call it whatever you'd like. But thoughts, ideas, feelings start to come. And so then I very often will have a sense of, oh, yes, this is a direction that the book wants to go in. This is what the characters want to do. But then once you actually start writing it, it's different because then you're manipulating words. There's a part of your brain that's thinking about punctuation. There's a part of your brain that's listening to the sound of the words as they come out, you know, and as they go onto the page. There's a part that's thinking ahead, what happens next, you know. So it becomes quite busy at that point.
I was going to ask you about the word listening that you used a little while ago and that you repeated just a second ago. I was wondering, you said here that you were listening to the words. Do you also listen to the characters? And is there any point in which that relaxation of the muscle that you used as a metaphor would allow the characters to actually dictate to you how they want to behave, in some ways passing the torch of control that you're holding from you to them?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Usually, I think books come to me as a voice. There's a tone to a book. And sometimes that tone comes very quickly, and sometimes it takes a long time to arrive. But sometimes I'll have an idea, but I can't start writing it until I can start to hear it. And so, for example, for my most recent novel, A Tale for the Time Being, the first thing that came to me was the voice of the protagonist, Nao Yasutani. And this was in December of 2006 or something, and I heard her voice, and she was introducing herself, and she said, "Hi, my name is Nao, and I'm a time being."
Which is the very beginning of the book.
Exactly. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I'll tell you. And there she was. I had her voice, and I wrote that down. And once she started talking, I kind of couldn't shut her up. She just kept going and going. And characters like that are wonderful to write. Not all of them are that cooperative. But when you find a character who really is eager to tell her story, there's no stopping them. They are just there and ready to go. So it's not like I'm actually hearing a voice in the way that I would hear a voice when you talk to me. It's not quite that. But there is a sense of the voice being there, that I am listening to it, and that the voice is telling me what to write. And so there is a sense of letting go of control and just allowing this thing to happen.
Before I go forward with A Tale for the Time Being, and I also want to talk about your other two books, My Year of Meat and Oliver Creation, I want to stop for a second on that beautiful image that you use when you refer to a book having a tone. And that it takes a while sometimes to find that tone, and sometimes that tone appears very quickly. Could you define what you mean by tone? Because I see and I hear what you say, but if I try to conceptualize exactly what the tone is, you're not talking about the tone of a character or the tone of a voice of a character. You're talking about the tone of a book. And the tone of a book is the symphony of all the tones that other characters in the background will have. And so what is that tone?
You know, don't really know how to describe it, but I think we all know it when we see it, when we see it, when we hear it, when we read it. And you're right, it's bigger than any of the characters. I think the voices of each character has his or her, their own voice as well. But this is bigger than that. And often it's the tone that perhaps the narrator sets. And so then you try to identify who the narrator is in a particular work, in a story that's being told in the first person. You know, presumably the narrator is the same as the character. So that makes it a little bit easier. But I also think that the tone resides slightly behind that first person character's voice, whatever that is. I would almost say that it's the attitude of the author somehow. It exists in that space between the author and the book. It's something in the atmospheric conditions that exist in that space, you know, right behind the book.
Do you think that we, real people, whatever that means, in the world have tones too, larger than the tone of our voices or the caliber of our thoughts or the scope of our actions, that there's a tone to us as well?
Yes, I think there is. I think there is. And I think we recognize that pretty quickly when we meet people. And we have a pretty quick sense of whether we like somebody or not, you know, and whether we're kindred spirits, whether we're members of the same tribe, you know. And I think that might have something to do with tone. It's a worldview. It's one's philosophical outlook. It's one's way of being in the world. And I think those are all phrases, I think, that can describe the tone of a book as well. It's a philosophy. Sort of a philosophical attitude, perhaps.
You talked about one of the protagonists of A Tale for the Time Being as a wonderful character and a very cooperative character, a character you liked very much. It almost sounded as if this character allowed you to open a faucet and the water was just coming out, as if you, rather than being the writer, you were the scribe or the secretary of the book. But what do you do with a character you don't like? What do you do with someone that doesn't want to cooperate? In a book like this one, made of 400 pages with so many different characters, there are meant to be some that you don't sympathize with.
You know, I think that's our job as writers, to figure out how to get inside the mind and the body and the psychology of the character, even if the character is not a terribly pleasant character. And I've certainly written my fair share of unpleasant characters, but I understand them. I understand them, and there's a part of me that loves them and sympathizes with them, even the most horrible ones, because I understand them. And so even their tonal range might not be the tonal range that I resonate with. On some level, I do. And I think that's also partly because characters, even the most hideous, heinous characters, evil villains, are a part of us. Terrible thing to confess, but my villains are part of me. They're parts of me. Where else can they come from, right? And so in order to write them well, in order to write them fully, I need to be willing to kind of go to those dark places.
Though this is not a formula, because you write beautiful books and there's no formula, there is a structure to them that a reader will notice. There are often alternative chapters that tell alternative narratives, alternative lives that might intersect early on or later on. They often happen in two different linguistic or national or cultural landscapes. Mm-hmm. For instance, in A Tale for the Time Being, there's a character called Ruth that is very similar to you. Mm-hmm. And there's the character of this Japanese girl whose lunchbox is discovered across the ocean, and that resulted from the tsunami in Japan. So it seems to me that the two sides of you, the Japanese and the American, and maybe the hyphen that exists in the middle, that bridge or that wall, is also the structure of your larger books, and that there's an attempt to look at the various parallel lives that you lead and bring them together, sometimes intersecting and sometimes not.
Absolutely. This was the structure that I started with when I wrote my first novel, My Year of Meats. And it was a structure that I've pretty much stayed with, although all over creation has a slightly more complex structure and there's more point of view characters. But there is always this multiplicity of voices. And generally, too, I think there's kind of a sense of alternating, a binary there. And I think it just simply reflects who I am and the way that I perceive the world. And when I was growing up, there was my Japanese mother, and the world was one way when I was with her. And then there was my Caucasian American father, and the world was another way when I was with him. And, you know, we lived together, but there was a sense that I was inhabiting two worlds at the same time. And I think, too, you know, one is always looking for a way to integrate. Right. And so sort of exploring this kind of back and forth relationship through books just seemed to come very naturally to me. And it seemed like an accurate or natural reflection of the way I also perceive and grew up in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
The three novels that you've published and that I have read deal with urgent topics in society. There's meat production. There is natural catastrophes. There is the agribusinesses in Iowa. What is the responsibility of the novel, if the novel has any responsibility, in this polyphonic way and world that you describe and in which we live?
I grew up in the 1970s, and one of the first things that I learned as an ardent young baby feminist was that the political is the personal. And so I've never been able to separate that duality. To my mind, this is one. And I think that's reflected as well in all of the books. For example, in My Year of Meats, a lot of the plot hinges around drugs that are given to cattle and also given to women, fertility drugs. But when you think about this, you know, on one hand, the pharmaceutical industry, the FDA, these drugs and pharmaceuticals are being regulated by these great corporate and governmental bodies. But at the same time, they're affecting the body of women, something as intimate and personal as the descent of an egg through a fallopian tube, through my fallopian tube. And so I don't see the political and the personal as being separate. I see them as being very much one. And what I didn't realize, you know, I never went to MFA school. I never studied writing. In fact, I come from a documentary film background, which once again, I sort of fell into. But in any case, you know, I was never trained in any formal way for any of the things that I've done. And so I never learned that you weren't supposed to do that, that art wasn't supposed to reflect politics. I think things are changing now. I think we're really seeing a kind of political consciousness in younger writers. But certainly when I was first starting to write and publish in the 80s and 90s, novels were not supposed to have political themes. They weren't supposed to have issues in them. So it was good that I didn't know that because I just was sort of naive and this interested me. And so I sort of stumbled into it and wrote about what seemed important.
Not having studied, not having had the instruments that a class or a school would have given you enabled you to spontaneously find your own niche in the way you would approach it.
Yeah. I never wanted my novels to be didactic. I realized that that was not a good way to get people interested because nobody likes to be preached to, right? Especially not in fiction. The fictional world is all about a dream. You don't want to have didactic tone to it. It goes back to this idea of tone. Then again, I mean, when I'm writing, I'm not really thinking about the reader. I'm not thinking that I want the reader to come away with this message or that lesson or, you know, anything like that. I wrote all of these books because there was something that perplexed me that I needed to make sense of. I needed to understand why I'd spent so many years working in commercial television, basically as an advertising flack for the tobacco industry and the meat industry. How could I have done that? Why did I do that? And so, you know, it was my own sense of confusion and remorse and wanting to understand what was behind that that led me to write the first book. And I think all of the books have been written out of a sense of remorse.
Which is also, as you said, something that you did in doing documentaries. The documentarist, if I could reduce it to a very succinct and fast definition, is the filmmaker that wants to study a particular topic from a variety of perspectives and give it to the viewers as a way to expand our vision. There is a documentary aspect in your books. And I wonder also, against that didactic element that you were talking about, if novels, when you finish them, there is a hope that they will make some change happen.
I think all art wants to be transformative. I don't think art wants to be pretty pictures on the wall. I don't think art wants to be decorative, necessarily. And so, yes, I mean, the books that I've read that have moved me have been transformative because they move you. It's such a beautiful word, really, when you think about it. It's so simple. Yes, it moves you. It moves you from here to there, right? And in so doing, it does affect a kind of transformation. And so I think novels want to do that. Not that the author or the writer is necessarily thinking about that. I don't think that's why anybody writes. It goes back to this idea that you write because you're trying to understand a feeling or a philosophical problem or a political problem or whatever it is. You want to get to the bottom of that somehow. And hopefully if you do it well, then the satisfaction of the journey that you're going through will somehow be reflected through the book and allow the reader to enter that same kind of journey so that your experience is reflected somehow by the reader's experience when they're reading the book. Having said that, of course, the reader brings his or her own completely vastly different set of experiences to the text. And so in that way, I can't really control very much the book that my reader reads. I do my job, put the book out into the world. But then after that, it's a collaboration. So, you know, the book that you read, that you and I have co-created, right, is very different than the book that other people have co-created.
With you too.
With me too. Yeah. I'm the collaborator, you know, I'm the kind of facilitator, the collaborator, but yeah.
By way of conclusion, in circling back to something you said earlier on, that beautiful image of you at three seeing your grandparents for the very first time, sitting at your level, meditating, and you discovering, without knowing it, of course, something that would define your life in the future and that they would bring you in. And also, because this is what I took from that part of your description, help you cope with the decline, the conclusion of the years of your parents. Mm-hmm. Has Sen also helped you mm-hmm. deal with your own aging? And does literature serve as well mm-hmm. in dealing with the way at one point you and I are not going to be here?
Mm-hmm. Let me answer the second part of the question first. What's so, of course, wonderful and magical about literature is that it's a form of time travel. It can transport me and you into vastly different eras and times. And so that's astonishing to me. And it's one of the really powerful and magical things about writing. The other thing, of course, is that writing persists. When I'm writing a novel, I'm very aware that I'm talking to people who are not hearing it right now. They're going to hear it sometime in the future. And possibly the people I'm talking to haven't been born yet. And so I'm writing this book that my collaborators will eventually get, but they might not even be on this earth yet. And so that's kind of a wonderful thing, right? It's a little bit mind-boggling. There's this wonderful idea that when you recite the poetry of a dead poet, it's actually the poet who is borrowing your tongue and coming back to life to borrow your tongue to have the poetry recited. That's kind of nice, too. You know, it's fun to think about those things. And as far as writing is concerned, I hope to die with a pen in my hand, like the old Zen poets, you know, the old Zen priests, the masters. The last thing they do before they keel over is to scribble a poem, and then boom, they're dead, you know. So that would be nice. That would be great. That brings me to the second part of your question, which is the question about Zen. And yes, absolutely. Zen meditation is, you know, it's so simple and it's so complicated. You know, one of the things that you're doing when you meditate is you're sitting there and you're allowing yourself to be with the things that frighten you. Things come up that frighten you, that you don't like, feelings, thoughts, fears. And you learn to sit with them. You learn to be patient with those fears and those kinds of feelings. Fear is a contracting kind of emotion. And so I think when we think about death, for example, and we're scared, right? And so we contract and then we get impatient and we get contracted around that fear. Whereas when you're meditating, okay, so the fear comes up, but you're still practicing just sitting with it in this kind of relaxed body and mind. And that helps when you're suffering. It helps to learn to do that. And so this is what I think, too. I'd very much felt that given the fact that this is inevitable, you know, I would like to know how to be with it in a way that doesn't make me crazy and doesn't start me spinning off into crazy places.
Well, Ruth Osecki, it has been extraordinary to have you on the show. And those of us who are here, and hopefully those of us who are not yet born, will continue to read you.
I hope so, too.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
What does your face say about you? Does your face change as you change, and vice versa? The face is the most puzzling of all body parts. It is our ID. People might have distinct hands, a singular way of walking, and other features. But those features seldom have the uniqueness of the face. Through the face, we appreciate character, demeanor, belief. I have never liked looking at myself in the mirror. I do it for as short a time as possible, to shave, to freshen up. Yet I know that when people look at me, it's my face they are looking at, and they do so for far longer periods of time than I do. I am aware of their stare. In fact, I don't mind it. Yet at times, I have the impression there's a gap between the person my face projects and the self inside it, or behind it, or located somewhere. In essence and in matter. When I see photos of myself, I can trace my development from childhood to adulthood. Those photos are frozen moments. They tell who I was on a particular day at a specific moment. They don't tell much about the self. That's why when I see them, I see myself, but I know I'm not there, but here, on the other side of the photo, looking at them from the future. Something similar happens with a mirror. I get the feeling the face that is staring at me isn't me. I'm different, freer, more fluid, less defined by age. I am the young man I was and the old man I will be, all together coexisting in the same body. Ironically, though we say that faces are our expression, they are incongruous. Oscar Wilde once said that a mask tells us more than a face. That's because a mask is set. Like a photograph, it doesn't change. No matter how many times we return to it, it is always the same. The face isn't. The face is always different. In that sense, it's an enigma. Next time on In Contrast.
Why is it that we are not surprised in Ramayana when Hanuman speaks Sanskrit and flies? He looks like a monkey. We know he's a monkey. We don't know any monkeys that speak Sanskrit or fly. This one does both, and we're like, it's okay.
Exploring the Ramayana with Arshia Sattar on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our intern is Delina Hadley. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.